The only other abominable snowman I can think of in movies is in Monsters, Inc., a movie that I really love. And the Yeti there is also really kind and generous and fun to be around. So maybe that's a running theme, but.
Welcome to the Himalayas.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Love that movie. Which we should talk about sometime. Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man-beast of Tibet, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you? The world's most shocking monster. No one's ever lived who's seen him. Be on your guard. He's coming to this theater. The abominable snowman dares you. We dare you. Dare you to see the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
What did it look like? Tell me, what did you see, Kusang? Tell me!
I see what men must not see.
They're after me. They know it was me that did it last night. They're after me.
They're after all of us. They just killed McNee.
Why say what? That? It was an accident.
It's me next. They know it was me.
Stay here.
Wait.
Ed, I can hear you. He's coming.
You've got to understand. That isn't Shelley. It isn't anybody.
I can hear his voice.
It's in your own mind. It's just happened to me, too.
Warning. Only those with stout nerves and strong hearts should risk seeing the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
So, Vincent, we have a special guest joining us today on this episode of Camp Kaiju, Steffi Theodora. Thank you so much for joining us.
Woo!
This is the sound of my voice. Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. Steffi, you and I connected on Instagram just as like mutual monster movie lovers a month ago, not too long ago. But I love the stuff you're putting on Instagram, and I'll give you a chance to talk about all that stuff. But kindred spirits, for sure. So thank you for being here to talk about this classic horror monster movie.
Yeah, pleasure is all mine. I've been a big fan of the show, and I love what you guys do. The last episode, well, not the one that came out today, but before, I was just laughing like so hard. I think you guys have huge comedy chops, and your like historical knowledge. It's just uncanny, the combination. So I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you, Steffi.
All right. Watch this episode completely crash and burn, but thank you for those kind words.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you again so much for being here. You're joining from Athens, Greece today, right?
That's right. Yes.
Very cool. Are you able to talk a little bit about like your monster movie background, like what you do on Instagram, maybe the name of your Instagram handle, and just kind of how you got into monster movies?
Sure. So I have been a screenwriter for the past 15 years. So I've mostly been writing kids' cartoons. And of course, like a lot of my inspiration has come from B movies from the 50s. And so like combining my passion with monster movies, I've always tried to like infuse that into my kids' cartoons. So some of the shows that I've worked on, like I'm usually the one who gets the monster episodes. And yeah, it's just somehow been this crazy thing that's brought me a lot of joy. You know, it's like a comfort food. And like, I also love hearing the old stories of the behind the scenes and the historical like significance of a lot of these movies. And of course, like, they're not just about monsters, as we will talk about today. They're always about something more philosophical and something different. And I find that that also isn't as pretentious as a lot of other films that try to say something. So I love monster movies that they're just easily accessible for a wider audience, where I feel like, you know, a lot of these serious dramas and stuff like that, you have to be like super smart to understand it. But monster movies have a great way of sneaking in really smart things, but also being like entertaining. And yeah, just for like the last couple of months, I decided to just take like my favorite movies and show the my favorite parts of them. So I call it a Monster Movie Minute, and I just go over like, oh, you haven't seen The Wasp Woman? Okay, here's like the best parts and why you should see it. And then like historically why it was significant. And then, you know, like questions like, oh, could that have been an inspiration for The Substance? Kind of thing. Or going through like the history of how they did the original Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney, just talking about, you know, when they're building, Universal was building the lot, what that looked like. So a lot of it's like historical, but then like infused with my personal love. And then yeah, it's all in 1 minute for the short attention spans, but like hopefully like getting younger people to like see like, oh, these old movies, these are really good, you know, they're worth checking out like you guys do.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Kindred spirits, because I started Camp Kaiju kind of in the same vein, like years ago, just like 5 minute episodes, nowhere near the production quality that you have on your Instagram, but certainly that idea of everything you enjoy today has its roots going back 100 years and more, even to literary sources. So just like storytelling itself, there are no new ideas, but there are always new and interesting twists and spins to these tried and true stories that gets me going as a writer. Matt's a writer too.
Right.
Indeed, we're all writers here. Yeah.
That's great. We'll have to write something together one day. That would be super cool.
That'd be amazing. Let's start working on that.
And expensive. I'm sure it'd be very expensive.
The ideas we would come up with.
Yeah.
We'll worry about budget later. Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you so much, Steffi. And yeah, totally agreed. Like, especially in the sense of like the blend of like genre entertainment and like thematic depth and like historical complexity. Like, you know, I know Vincent feels this way too, but I just think that if you can present that stuff through like fun, visceral genre entertainment, that kind of makes everything more engaging, more like more powerful in a way, even if it kind of sneaks up on you a little bit. So yeah, kindred spirits, like Vincent said, for sure. So today we are talking about The Abominable Snowman from 1957, which is a maybe not an early Hammer horror film, but like relatively early in their horror heyday. They didn't really start focusing on horror and science fiction until the mid-50s, mostly due to the success with films like The Curse of Frankenstein and also The Quartermass Experiment. We'll be talking a little bit about that more in this episode. So a relatively early Hammer horror film, if not an early Hammer film itself. This was also known as The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas in the United States upon its release. Just wanted to throw that out there as well. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today, friends. Please rate and review the show and follow us on patreon.com/campkaiju for additional videos, reviews, merchandise, and more. Other ways you can get in touch are via email, campkaiju@gmail.com, on our website, campkaijupodcast.com, on Instagram, and our voicemail number, 612-470-2612. Special thank you to our current Patreon members, Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, Superfan Don, Steffi, our guest star today, and our anonymous patron. Thank you so much. So yeah, thank you so much to our Patreon members. Sign up and get, you know, some special swag announcements. Who knows what's going to come up in the future. So thank you again.
I'm doing some blogs every now and then. I just released one featuring famous actors from Minnesota, like James Arness, who is in The Thing from Another World, and Them, even Josh Hartnett, more recent actors as well, Winona Ryder. So like that's on there for patrons. I still go back to little 5-minute short videos, just me blabbing about my monster movie collection and kind of what I'm up to. And so, yeah, there's lots of things to check out on the Patreon and some additional nuts and bolts just real quick. Coming up February 11th, that's a Wednesday, February 11th, in St. Paul, Minnesota at the Black Heart Bar. You can join me at the Black Heart, where I will present as a part of the Nerd Night programming. I've talked about this before, but it's a really cool organization, maybe. I don't know, but they do it across America in bars. And the conceit is that you can present, you can sign up to present on any topic you just like really nerd out about. Well, here I am with a podcast, Total Nerd, and I thought for a 10-minute slideshow, like it's really short, it's a 10-minute slideshow, I will present to a bar full of patrons, and they will ask me questions. And my topic is going to be, who would win in a fight, the Blob or the Thing? And what makes that interesting, and this is an argument all over the internet, you can look it up, what makes it interesting is that the Blob absorbs creatures, and the Thing assimilates creatures. So there's a difference in that. What that is, I'll really get into the nuts and bolts, if you will. But who would win in that hypothetical battle? Listeners out there in the world, if you have any thoughts, send them our way. And maybe I will definitely listen to those arguments as I construct my slideshow presentation. So that's really cool, exciting, and just dumb fun coming up. Some other really cool, exciting news is the Rondo Awards nomination process is open. A little bit about the Rondo Hatton Horror Awards. They are prestigious awards, and they honor horror media from the past year, mostly in the classic realm. Camp Kaiju last year was nominated for Best Podcast with like four others, including Frankenstein Minute and Monster Kid Radio, Friends of the Pod, shows that I've been on, shows that they have joined us on. So the Rondo Awards are fan-based, and you as a listener, I would encourage you to go throw Camp Kaiju into the mix. And you could do this one of two ways. You can go to the Classic Horror Film Board, just Google that, and you'll see information about the Rondo Awards. You can email the runner of the Rondo Awards, and his name is David Colton at taraco@aol.com. Or you can just go to our patreon.com/campkaiju one-stop shop, and you can read my own post about that with related links. So please, if you feel so inclined, give Camp Kaiju a nomination.
Awesome. Thank you, Vincent. We always do something on Camp Kaiju where we take a look back at monster movies that came out around this time in horror movie history. So for us, that'll be like late January, early February. I have a list of movies here that came out around this time of year. Steffi, do any of those titles kind of jump out at you? Is there anything you want to shout out on that list?
Well, I love The Incredible Shrinking Woman. I think that movie does not get enough credit. It's insane, the props, everything. And so that it came out in, yeah, like this time of year is pretty cool. Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, I had no idea like how, yeah, when that was received. So I'm imagining people with like their coats on going into the theater and what, they paid like a penny or something to see the serial. An Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is crazy because you guys were also mentioning this on a previous podcast. This time of year, the movies were released kind of in thought that they wouldn't be considered for an award. Is that right? It's kind of too late for the big awards.
Yeah.
I think certainly for in recent history. I'm not sure about the past.
Okay. Yeah, because Invasion of the Body Snatchers for me, I mean, like that one definitely should have gotten some kind of award. And Matinee, I mean, that's too bad for Joe Dante and I guess William Castle, but it didn't get enough recognition. But yeah, no, it's a fabulous list. Videodrome. Oh, Lost World. And you guys are covering Lost World 2 this year, right?
We are. Yeah. Yeah, we'll be talking about that one soon. I wish we could have made that in for its centennial last year in 2025, but we're just a little bit late. So happy to be talking about that one soon.
That's okay.
Willis O'Brien will never forgive us.
Yeah.
I want to shout out In the Mouth of Madness, a John Carpenter film from 1995, released this time that year. I just recently watched it for the first time, and it is madness. At first, for me, it was kind of like a slow burn trying to get into it. But then by like the final third of the film, it was a roller coaster of madness with Sam Neill. Would recommend.
Well, okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah, that's a great movie. That's a good latter day John Carpenter. I recently watched Ghosts of Mars, which I really love. And I didn't have high expectations because, Vincent, we've talked about Vampires, the John Carpenter movie, on the podcast before, which I didn't like very much, and I don't think you did either. But Ghosts of Mars is like way better, and it came right after Vampires. So I chose the wrong late Carpenter movie. Sorry about that.
It's a better title than just Vampires.
Yeah.
Ghosts of Mars really captures the imagination.
Totally. And that's the movie in a nutshell, way more original and creative than Vampires is. So maybe we'll bring that to the pod someday.
Maybe.
The movie that I want to shout out on this list is Phenomena from 1985. That's by Dario Argento. Very young Jennifer Connelly is in that movie. She plays a girl at like a boarding school in Italy where a bunch of people have been killed recently in true giallo fashion. And Jennifer Connelly's character turns out to have a weird relationship with insects. Like, she can call insects to her and like make them attack people. And that helps her kind of like solve the crime. It's a really weird giallo, very stylish, like all of Dario Argento's movies. Top three Argento, I would say. So that's a really good one.
Sweet.
And I'll check that out too.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys are fans of giallo or Dario Argento. He has some bad movies, but like Suspiria, Opera, Tenebrae, Deep Red, those are all pretty great, in my opinion. In terms of new and upcoming releases, there are some good pseudo-monster movies coming out. Have either of you seen the new 28 Years Later Bone Temple movie yet?
No, that just dropped, right?
Yeah, I think maybe a week ago, yeah.
I love 28 Years Later, so I'm super excited to see what they did with it. Did you see 28 Years Later?
Yeah. Yep. I mostly really liked it a lot. There are a few small things I didn't like, but Ralph Fiennes is amazing in that movie.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, they shot them both together, so I guess it's kind of this good continuation. So very excited to see that one.
Definitely. Yeah. I've heard good things about Primate, which just seems like such a ridiculous, like, monkey on the loose sort of, you know, creature feature. Surprisingly, that's supposed to be pretty good. All You Need Is Kill is a new anime movie with a great title. I love that title. And yeah, Steffi, you're kind of highlighting this right now. I don't know if you knew that Luc Besson has a new Dracula movie coming out.
This is the one with Christopher Waltz, right? I saw it because I live in Europe. I saw a trailer and I was like, what the hell is this? And it was in a different language. And I was like, is this like old or new or what is happening here? And because they speak French, it's all in French, I believe, the film. Is that
I think
correct?
So. I don't really know very much about it, but I think so, yeah.
But I guess it has good reviews. It's supposed to be very good.
Okay.
There's something in the water, I think, with reimagining the classic monsters. How many Frankenstein adaptations are we getting? There's The Bride coming out, directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal. And then Universal's releasing yet another Mummy film, directed by Lee Cronin, this time around. The trailer, I don't know. I think it looks promising. It looks like a proper horror film rather than the action adventure that was the Tom Cruise one. So I'm hoping at least it's scary. That's all I would just, even if it's not like great, quote unquote, I just want it to be a proper horror film.
It didn't look mummy enough for me. Like it looked too horror. I was like, where's the mummy? I want more mummy, you know? But yeah, it kind of seems like this thing where every 10 years they're sort of rebooting them. And whether they're successful or not, like we kind of forget like the bad ones. And then they just redo them like all over again. So, and they're making, I don't know if you guys saw that, Tim Burton's redoing Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. Sorry,
I've been
Margot
following
Robbie.
That closely.
Oh, yeah. What's the latest on that one?
I think they're just still in talks, really.
Okay.
Redevelopment. So nothing new, but I hope that comes to pass because that is such a great story. I mean, the original is so fun in a campy way. that I'd love to see a modern take on it. In addition to the, what was the one from 1990? 89, something like that. There was another one.
Daryl Hannah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Tim Burton needs to redeem himself. Like, I think he owes us a good movie after all these years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Come on, Tim. You can do it. There's one more. I know it.
Yeah. There's got to be. What happened?
If anything's getting back on track, you would think it would be that movie. You know, it's perfect.
Yes. Handing it to you on a platter. It's Margot Robbie. Come on.
How can you screw this
screw
up?
This up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like with the new Dracula, it's like, yeah, it would be nice if they would maybe not go back to the same well over and over again and maybe make something new. But, you know, somebody like Luc Besson who's interesting, like even though he's hit or miss, but like always pretty interesting. It's like, I'll show up for that and see what he does with it. So we'll see. Yeah. In terms of what's coming up on Camp Kaiju, next up we'll have Blackula featuring our frequent guest star, Sean Pryor. Vincent, you're bringing that to the podcast. Is there anything you want to say about that one?
No, just looking forward to it. Sean Pryor is always a delight to have on the show, a good friend of ours. So looking forward to that one. After that, I just need to double check, Matt. I do not believe it's Troll Hunter.
I think in that case, it's probably Alucarda, the Mexican horror movie.
Correct.
Which is like a gothic film set at a convent, I believe. It's kind of about demonic possession and things like that. I don't know a lot about it, but it's high on most of the lists of best Mexican horror movies of all time. So very excited for that.
Nice. And then a special episode, we're going to have author and monster movie enthusiast Tom Shubilla on the show. He has written a historical book about King Kong versus Godzilla, the Toho film from the 60s, and the cultural impact of the film. So he reached out asking if he could stop by camp. And I said, absolutely. Let's talk about your book and talk about some Showa-era Godzilla films. So looking forward to that.
Absolutely. That'll be fun. All campers welcome here on Camp Kaiju. So if there's anything you want to reach out about, I mentioned some of the ways you can do so earlier, and we'll mention those again. But please let us know if you have any ideas or feedback on the show.
Yeah.
But today, again, we're talking about The Abominable Snowman from Hammer Studios. What are our personal histories with this movie? Steffi, do you have a personal history with this movie or with Hammer films in general?
I do. So with this movie, it was one of those really hot days in the summer, you know, when it was like August on a Saturday, just like you think you're going crazy. And I was like, I need to watch something to get my mind off of this heat. Like, what can I watch? I just need to do something. And then I said, oh, it's finally time for Abominable Snowman. So I'm a big Val Guest fan. So Val Guest directed fantastic film, The Day the Earth Blew Up, if you've seen that one. It's definitely worth checking out. The Day the Earth Caught Fire, which is not a movie you want to watch when it's super hot out, because that movie is very hot. So I thought, okay, I'll put on Abominable Snowman. And then, yeah, I actually am not like the biggest Hammer horror fan. I am like revisiting a lot of their kind of odd films now. So I just watched The Gorgon. But like initially, like this kind of gothic like thing isn't really like slow burn isn't really my thing. So I was really pleasantly surprised and totally like captivated by this film as soon as I saw it. I just, you know, I'm really into the anamorphic lens thing and the fact that this was Hammer's first time using those lenses. And it's just like this wide screen of these beautiful shots, and like Peter Cushing, like his ability to just play a character that you love so much, you know, and you really root for, is like pretty uncanny. And yeah, I just thought the atmosphere of this, and I loved everything about it immediately, and was trying to like tell everyone I know, like, you gotta see this movie and stuff. So yeah, I've been in love with it since I first saw it. And when I saw you guys were gonna do it, I was like, oh yeah, that would be like my number one choice. So I'm glad we get to talk about it today.
That's awesome. It's a perfect fit. Yeah.
Did it accomplish your goal of taking your mind off of the heat?
How like hot it was. Yeah, I think, you know, it's got so much snow and atmosphere and you really feel like, you know, and I guess when they shot it in England as well, like those sets, like it was really cold too. You can see their breath, and it actually was freezing for them. So I think it does work if you're in a situation and you're like needing to cool down, you know, watch a movie that like, yeah, makes you feel like you're outside.
Yeah, totally. I had never heard of this movie, honestly, until Matt recommended it for the show. I am not super familiar with like the Hammer output. I've seen a few things. I've seen the Gorgon, actually. But it's one of those facets of the genre of horror movies that I have yet to deep dive into. So I'm excited for this chance to do that.
Like you, Vincent, I didn't really know very much about this movie. I had seen a handful of Hammer horror films, which, Steffi, kind of like you were saying, maybe a little bit hit or miss for me. I don't necessarily love most of the ones that I've seen. But I do like The Gorgon quite a bit. The Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed I thought was pretty good. So this one I read was kind of an underrated early Hammer horror picture. I was excited to check it out. Yeah, it was different than I expected it to be, perhaps in both good and bad ways, but I'm excited to talk about it today.
Name?
Wait a minute.
There's scores of them coming down. What are they? Meteorites?
These are different.
Marsh, your face! There was something on your face!
Just how much do you know about a place called Winterden Flats?
You must know as well as I do that Winterden Flats is top secret.
Secret?
Why are the police here? What did this? You know what did it. Tell us and try to save her.
We trace the source of these things. It's in a freak orbit.
Inside those domes, a creature from outside this earth, producing deadly poison.
This infection is widespread.
Look out!
Are you mad?
I've seen them. Thousands of tiny creatures that can join together and expand into things 100 feet high.
More than 100 years ago, in a mountain village in Switzerland, lived a man whose strange experiments with the dead have since become a legend. A legend that is still told with horror the world over.
We've only just started, just opened the door. But now's the time to go through that door and find what lies beyond it. But don't you see, Paul? We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
This is Frankenstein, who revolted against nature, who experimented with the devil and was forever cursed. His unwilling collaborator was Paul Kremp.
I can't prove you murdered, but I can stop you using his brain.
Why, he has no further use for it.
Don't be a fool! Be careful! You damage it!
Only two women ever entered this house of evil.
Elizabeth, come back!
Elizabeth, the lovely cousin who had promised to marry him, and Justine, the maid, who kept passionate and secret rendezvous with her master.
Won't you understand you're in real danger? What Victor is doing is dangerous to everyone in the house. Now, you cannot possibly conceive what dreadful thing he's planning to do.
What are you trying to tell me, Paul? That Victor's wicked? Insane?
Wicked? Insane? Evil? Call Frankenstein what you will. A demon had made a man-made monster. And now, the monster was the master.
Paul, what are you going to do? For your sake and to protect Elizabeth, I've so far kept silent. But now I shall go to the authorities and have them destroy that creature. And see that you pay for these atrocities. No!
The preceding program has been a fully sponsored paid program. The airtime for this program has been paid for by Health and Tennis Corporation.
You're watching WGBO-TV, Joliet, Chicago. Good morning. and welcome to the 66 Morning Movie. Today, she's the queen and her sting is deadly. Susan Cabot is the Wasp Woman.
Supposing a more powerful form of royal jelly could be obtained. From the queen wasp, for example.
Socially, the queen wasp is on level with a black widow spider.
Oh, no. There might be danger.
Those are my terms, Mr. Fincher. Janice Starlin will be your next guinea pig.
A woman of fantastic desires. Sponsoring a scientist with fantastic theories. And demanding fantastic results.
How old do I look? Tell me! How old?
23. The enzymes, they're going crazy. Miss Darling will kill her and tear her body to shreds.
So let's dive into the crew a little bit. Steffi, it sounds like you're a big Val Guest fan, who is the director of the film. Are you able to talk about Val Guest a little bit? You can go off the bullet points here or just talk about whatever comes to mind if you want.
Well, as one of my favorite things about him is that he was a journalist for the Hollywood Reporter back in the day in England when I think there was only like two. And he would review movies coming out of England. And one, he kept going after this one producer, like saying like, oh man, you made another bad movie. Like how long are you gonna keep doing this? And in one article, he actually like calls out to the producer like, hey, I can write something way better than anything that you're making. And the producer wrote an open letter to him and said, okay, challenge accepted. Why don't you write a movie? And that's how Val Guest got his start, was as a screenwriter. And he did start writing really great films. And yeah, and you know, I feel like he's really kind of unknown compared to a lot of other directors, and which is sort of unfair. Unfortunately, he directed sort of the worst James Bond movie of all time. So he directed Casino Royale, which I actually love because it's super campy and stuff. So that kind of was like a little bit of a bruise on his career. But yeah, as far as like his early life was concerned, I didn't know his parents were divorced when he was young.
His parents tried to hide the divorce from him, so they lied and said, like, his father lied and said that his mom had died, which is just crazy to me. And I, you know, my brain is just like, oh, did that lead to some of his later sort of like horror like aspects a little bit? I don't know if that's true, but just interesting backstory.
Yeah, that is crazy. And actually, that is interesting because in some of his films, how he does depict marriage. So specifically, he did a film called Oh, Hell is a City, which is a great title, I feel. And that at the center of that is this kind of not happy marriage. So maybe that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in my opinion, he's a fantastic like thriller director. And I think you see that in this film, too. You're sort of like, oh, my gosh, what's about to happen? What's about to happen? If you guys have seen Cater Mass Experiment, you know, that was like revolutionary film that just keeps moving at this pace where a lot of sci-fi elements, but at the core, he's just a great thriller director. And yeah, I think you can really see that in this film. And yeah, he lived pretty long too. He lived into the early 2000s.
Cater Mass Experiment, I always see pop up on these lists of great movies to check out. Like I said, I have yet to do that, but It's high on my list. I just was Googling, you know, where is it streaming? Tubi, of course it is. So I'll be checking that out.
Yeah, it's really special. And it's similar to this film where it's suspenseful and it's sort of questioning, should we go after the unknown?
It's a classic theme.
interesting. Yeah, for the 50s, you know, there's a lot of like, don't go there because of atomic stuff, or oh, the atomic thing or whatever, but like, oh, maybe we should stop exploring is an interesting like concept.
Yeah. And maybe even a little bit of a theme in this movie too. I might talk about Niger Neal a little bit, who is the screenwriter of the film. So he's from the Isle of Man. He started off in television. He joined the BBC in 1951 as a television writer. Like we were just talking about, he created the fictional scientist Bernard Cattermass and wrote the BBC TV serial featuring that character, which aired in 1953, and then the two Hammer films that featured him, which both came out in 1955. I thought this was really interesting, and I didn't actually know this before. Most BBC TV productions in the 1950s were live plays that were broadcast live and weren't even recorded. So there's like there aren't recordings of many of these BBC airings, including like the Cattermass ones and some of the other ones that Niger Neal wrote back in the day, which I think is pretty fascinating.
And the Abominable Snowman was one of those plays on television?
Yes.
And called The Creature?
Sorry, yeah, called The Creature. You're right about that. That's a little bit more in the production backstory section, so we'll definitely get to that a little bit as well.
I'm sorry, Mr. Levine. I'll remember my place next time.
No, it's a good foreshadowing. We will definitely return to that. But yeah, so he wrote a lot of TV scripts back in the day. Some critics claim that Neal invented popular TV, which seems like a broad, you know, kind of exaggerated claim, but maybe there's some credence to it. But he wrote a lot of other screenplays and scripts as well. He wrote the kitchen sink drama Look Back in Anger from 1959, which is really a classic British film directed by Tony Richardson. He won a BAFTA award for that one. Niger Neal did. He wrote adaptations of Wuthering Heights in 1984, and he also wrote the screenplay for a TV broadcast called The Year of the Sex Olympics from 1968, which some people say foreshadowed the rise of reality TV. It's one of the first kind of reality TV satires in television history. So pretty fascinating guy, Niger Neal.
Oh, and I just have one thing to add to that, which I just found out today. So when Joe Dante wanted to do a reboot of or a remake of The Creature from the Black Lagoon, he called Niger Neal in and actually did his take on it. And because of Neal's style, which isn't very violent, which is very suspenseful, actually Joe Dante and him parted ways on the project and it never came to be.
Interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
But apparently there is a script that was written and we should try to get our hands on it.
It's out there.
Yeah, man. It's out there.
I think there are about a dozen Creature from the Black Lagoon scripts out there somewhere. I don't know if they're as good as Niger Neal's, but yeah, that's one the studios have not tried to. Well, maybe the closest we got to is The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
Arthur Grant, Hammer's resident cinematographer. He shot Hammer films such as Shadow of the Cat from 1961, The Curse of the Werewolf, The Phantom of the Opera from 1962, The Plague of the Zombies, and The Devil Rides Out. I have yet to see those movies, but based on his work in The Abominable Snowman, high praise. I think, not to give away too much of my later review, but I think the photography in this movie is beautiful.
Agreed. Yeah. And, you know, I think Arthur Grant became Hammer's resident cinematographer because he worked very quickly and very cheaply, like much more so than the previous cinematographer for Hammer. I can't remember his name right now, but Grant, you know, he was able to like finish a setup really quickly. They would just like blaze through all the camera setups they had that day, which makes sense for Hammer. And the fact that he could do such good work on that schedule and that budget is pretty impressive.
And you say that, and I think that like, He works very efficiently. And I could see that in The Abominable Snowman. I could see that maybe the budget is kind of low and he's working with what he has. With that said, he knows how to use shadows and perspective and those sweeping aerial shots. My God. So yeah, he's really efficient, but in a very intelligent man knows what he's doing type of way.
Absolutely, yeah. An expert craftsman. So I just want real quickly want to talk about Forrest Tucker, who's an American actor in the film. He plays a boorish American named Tom Friend, who is interested in the wealth and fame that he can get by capturing the abominable snowman. Tucker began in vaudeville, fought in World War II. He was made famous by westerns and action movies, though he returned to comedies and musicals later in his career. An early breakout role for him was in The Westerner from 1940, starring Gary Cooper. He later appeared in films such as The Yearling, Sands of Iwo Jima, The Strange World of Planet X, and The Trollenberg Terror. Those last two movies were both made in England, so Tucker spent some time in the late 50s making British horror movies, particularly for Hammer Studios. But I feel like the real draw on the cast here, and maybe the most legendary figure in horror cinema, is Peter Cushing, and I wanted to throw it out there. Do either of you guys want to talk about him? Steffi, are you a particular Peter Cushing fan?
Yes, I mean, of course, as a kid, my first encounter with him was General Tarkin. And so, of course, it's so delightful to go back through history and see, like, what he was doing. He was also a man who was really dedicated to England and staying within the studio systems there, which is why we never saw him in the States until George Lucas kind of brought him there. So I found that to be really interesting. I guess Oliver Reed also had that sort of mindset of like, no, I work in England, I work in British film, I don't need to go over to that rat race. So I find that really admirable. You know, he was working with Sir Laurence Olivier. He was touring with him on some productions and learned a lot of his acting technique from Laurence Olivier. There's a certain Peter Cushing move that he does, which he does in this film as well, where he will take his arm that is the furthest away from the camera, and there'll be a small moment where he will point to his eye to steal the scene, to sort of bring everyone's attention in, which he said he learned from Laurence Olivier. So yeah, that's really interesting. So if you're a big Peter Cushing fan, you're watching a movie with him, there's a good chance in one scene, just for a second, he'll raise his index finger and point to his eye that's furthest from the camera so that everyone on set and all the energy suddenly goes to him for his like important dramatic moment. And I just love that he did that. But yeah, Vince, did you want to talk more about like his like the films that he was in and stuff?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So he did work briefly in Hollywood in the late 30s. But like you said, returned to England at the start of World War II and just kind of planted himself there. His career in England did struggle, however, until he started to work in live TV plays for BBC. He appeared in 22 Hammer horror films. That's a lot. And that's why he's iconic. He played Baron Frankenstein in 7 of their Frankenstein films, Dr. Van Helsing in 5 Dracula films. He played Sherlock Holmes in The Hound of the Baskervilles. He became close friends with Christopher Lee, who I was going to say was his frequent co-star in all those films. So if you're watching a Hammer Peter Cushing film, there's a good chance Christopher Lee is in that as well. And those two on screen together, just electric. So really the draw. I mean, even like if the movie's kind of ho-hum, if Cushing is on the screen, I'm like, yeah, he's got such screen presence. He could just lift his finger to his eye and I'm riveted. So that's kind of my draw to him and many others, I'm sure. He played Doctor Who in the mid 60s. I didn't know that. That's cool. And yeah, he was in Star Wars, like Steffi, like you said. That was my first presence, my first encounter with him, certainly. So it's fun to see him in Star Wars now and be like, oh, what a cameo. Like you don't realize how much of a big deal that was.
I feel like, you know, you talk about a screen presence, Vincent. I feel like he just has the ability to like play pretty ridiculous roles sometimes. Like the dialogue might be a little bit absurd in some cases, but he's able to present it with like seriousness, but like maybe there's like a level of camp like underlying that a little bit, you know, because it's so serious.
There's a glint in his eye. You could tell he's having fun.
Yeah.
Which I so appreciate. I want the actors to, take the content seriously. Like, they're not making fun of the abominable snowman. And yet, you could tell he's just having fun. Maybe off camera, they're telling jokes, they're playing with props. I don't know. There's a sense of camaraderie on the screen that I think goes a long way.
Did you guys hear about his nickname on this film?
Yes.
They gave him the nickname Props.
Props Cushing.
Right. And a lot of times those were surprises to his like co-actors on like film. So the scene where he's with the llama and he pulls out the cigarette and he even asks the llama if he can smoke, that actually wasn't planned at all.
That's amazing.
And when they have the tooth, he pulls out the, okay, he measures it, but then he pulls out a nail file and he hands it to Helen. And that actually all was just a surprise that Peter Cushing did. So I guess he used to like load his pockets with stuff and then just like bring it on set and then try to surprise everyone.
And his co-stars would have to try to not laugh or like break character.
Right.
Because what are you doing, Peter? That's not in the script.
That must have added some like really nice spontaneity, you know, like maybe when the script is a little bit on the dry side, like doing stuff like that maybe like engages the actors a little bit more. So subtly brilliant on Cushing's part.
A level of realism, I think, that especially in plays and movies, sometimes if you're going by the script, you can lose out on those little things like, I'm going to pull out a cigarette, I'm going to light a smoke. Oh, do you mind? No, go for it. And it's just that level of, like, those are the little things that life is made up of. And, you know, using props correctly can highlight that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so rounding out the cast in The Abominable Snowman, we have Maureen Connell as Helen Rollison, the doctor's wife. Richard Wattis as Foxy, another scientist stationed at the Tibetan monastery. Wolf Morris, an English-Russian actor, playing the Sherpa Kusang. So from modern standards, that casting is probably not super PC. But again, through the lens of presentism, you know, this movie was made 70 years ago almost at this point. And then the llama of the monastery is played by Arnold Marley, a German actor who appeared in a lot of British films and television programs throughout his very long career. All right, let's move to the production backstory a little bit. Vincent, you brought up the creature, the BBC live TV drama. Do you want to get us started here?
Yeah, so Nigel Neal wrote this play called The Creature. First of all, I would love to see this story on stage. That's my bread and butter as a writer, so like, amazing. How do you pull that off? But he was one of several writers that wrote for BBC in the early and mid-50s. He was inspired by then-popular rumors of the Yeti, the, you know, also known as the Abominable Snowman. And the Yeti was, so this is where I'll get into a little bit of that history. The Yeti legend of the Abominable Snowman really started in the, you know, in the West, you could say, in the 1920s, but it wasn't made famous until the discovery of footprints by a British explorer named Eric Shipton in 1951, who was actually mentioned in the script, in the screenplay of The Abominable Snowman. I think it is Tom Friend who's like, well, in 1951, we had those footprints. So the legend was at large at this point. And then in 1954, Sir Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa guide, Tenzing Norgay, they ascended Mount Everest, the first confirmed climb to the peak of Mount Everest in the 50s. So there was a huge fascination, not only with the Yeti legend, but also just Mount Everest in the 1950s. And just speaking off the cuff, you know, the Himalayas you could think of as a last frontier of humankind. Going under the ocean, going into outer space, going to the Himalayas, like these were parts of the world yet unexplored, again, by at least Westerners, that really captured the imagination, and I could see why. Are there monsters up there? Nobody really knew. So historically, pretty fascinating. But anyways, this play, The Creature, then, was broadcast live in January of 1955. It did receive mixed reviews. Some critics called it dry, unrealistic. But nonetheless, Hammer purchased the rights to the production, and Neal wrote the screenplay. So he stayed faithful to his TV script. Though he did add the subplot with Helen Rollison, and she was a new character for the film, and also the Foxy character. That sounds so funny. What is his name? Yeah, I guess his name is Foxy.
That's what they call him. I wonder if he has a different...
Yeah, his name is like, that's his nickname. I think his last name is Fox. or something.
Yeah, that makes sense to
but
me. Yeah.
When they called him that, I was like, oh, what's he going to do? Is he like the third man? Like, what's the deal with this character? I'm glad they added him. But I was always like, oh, what's this guy going to do? He's going to do something.
But he seemed a little shifty.
Yeah.
Like, he's so proper. You wonder, is he hiding something? Didn't quite go that way.
Maybe not very foxy. More shifty than foxy, I would say.
Sly, like a fox.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
The characters of Helen and Foxy were added to the film by Neil.
And also for the time, what was kind of rare is the Daily Post published this like contest, basically. So they would award anyone $5,000 if they had proof of the Yeti existing. So there was a lot of hype at the time of people like, you know, really putting themselves in danger to come back with some sort of proof. So that this film came out at that perfect time where everybody was like, oh, there is a huge possibility. Edmund Hillary, too, the explorers that Vincent mentioned, those guys were really well respected. And for them to come down from like a giant mountain and be like, whoa, we saw these like huge footprints that definitely cannot be human. You know, everyone really believed them. So this was like peak. There is a giant snowman living in the Himalayas fascination time, which would be so cool, you know. And this also is the time when it's called cryptozoology. Yeah, that also started to sort of surface as this kind of quasi-scientist study of animals that couldn't be proven, which I also love. And I just think we need way more of those and those movies. To ignite like the public's imagination about something that could be living on Earth among us that we haven't found yet, I think is so great. So Hammer purchased the rights to the production, having found success with their recent adaptation of the Quatermass Experiment. You know, wrote the screenplay. And then it was co-produced by American producer Robert Lippert, who partnered with Hammer on many films around that time, and he would provide an American star in exchange for the rights to distribute Hammer's film in the U.S. And Lippert brought Forrest Tucker, though director Val Guest was disappointed with his performance. Oh, Forrest Tucker might have been very good at some things, too, but many people's mind acting wasn't one of them, and I think he rather spoiled the picture, which is what Val Guest said about his performance.
I don't think he was that bad.
Right.
In a lot of ways, he really underplays the role, which is kind of nice. He downplays it. If you look at Forrest Tucker and other pictures, you know, he's this like larger than life, like dominating figure. So, I don't know. He had some beef with Val Guest, I guess. And Cushing reprised the role that he played in the TV play. That was his second appearance for Hammer after The Curse of Frankenstein. So, and The Curse of Frankenstein came out the same year, which also then threw Hammer into this like super famous position, right?
Yeah, that's what I read too. Mm-hmm. Good year for Peter Cushing.
Yeah, and for Hammer Studios.
Yeah.
So On Location shooting took place in the French Pyrenees in January 1957. The second unit footage did not include the main actors, so doubles were used whenever the characters appeared from a distance. And to me, those are some of the best shots in the movie, like these sweeping aerial shots of the mountains, which we've already talked about before. It's really gorgeous, especially because the film was shot in an anamorphic widescreen format called Regalscope, later renamed as Hammerscope by the studio, which I love that they kind of trademarked that themselves. And Steffi, you were talking about this before. I do think it's a really beautiful visual style, but director Val Guest actually did not like it very much. Apparently, shooting in this format made it very difficult to get close to the actors and required really meticulous framing, like even more so than usual. So it looks great, but was apparently pretty difficult to work with.
Yeah, I have to say, I shot a short film with anamorphic lenses, trying to be this cool hipster shooting in CinemaScope. And it's so difficult because you're working on such a wide plane and you have to fill the space, right? And so if you've got one character, if you just put him in the middle and then you just have landscape around him, it's like super tricky. And there are certain points in this film where you can see guests struggling with that balance because you just, he has so much more space to work with and how to fill it and how to make it look interesting. But yeah, I mean, it was a revolutionary way to see pictures, right? To go from something that was nearly square to this widescreen. Yeah, it's beautiful for being outside for those big shots.
And it must have been especially a striking contrast for anybody that saw the TV play, and you just think of TVs at that time being relatively small and obviously like square in format, then to go to this like huge widescreen theatrical format must have been pretty cool for people who saw both versions around that time.
Definitely. And some of those aerial shots that they did, they would either take them, there was like one helicopter flight that they went over the Andes or the Pyrenees. And then another shot that they had was there was like a ski lift cable cars. And so there's certain shots that were taken and you can kind of see the way that it pans that they're like sitting in this little ski lift with the camera out the window shooting these establishing shots. Yeah, not with the actual crew, with stuntmen. They took stuntmen up there, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and a lot of that is seamless, right? Between the studio and between those location shots, it looks great.
Yeah.
I love that. Like it does look great, but like I love it when you have these kind of like pretty obviously artificial like tundra sets or like the North Pole or whatever. But I think it looks so cool, like the, you know, the fake snow and like the really kind of like blocky, like ice and everything in the background. Like, I love that look. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms also had that a little bit, which we talked about last year.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't surprisingly distract me. Like, I could tell it was artificial, like on their sets. Filmed, by the way, at Bray and Pinewood Studios in England. But maybe because it was blended so well with the live action shots, yeah, it did not distract me.
Yeah, same. I think it's done really well. And again, I really love that look. I think it's very cinematic, you know?
Mm-hmm. The sets for the monastery were built at Bray Studio and were later reused for a series of Fu Manchu movies in the 60s starring Christopher Lee. Most of the extras in The Abominable Snowman were waiters at a Chinese restaurant, or just multiple Chinese restaurants in London. Awesome. And then Val Guest, for his part, he encouraged the actors to overlap their dialogue to contribute to a more realistic feel. Guest also wanted to show the creature of the Yeti only in glimpses to build suspense. By contrast, Nigel Neal thought the creatures should be showed in their entirety. So, spoiler alerts for listeners, the Yeti isn't shown until the end of the film. A classic monster movie technique we all know, whether it's Jaws or what have you, that we're saving the goods to the end. Until then, we're going to give you little snippets, maybe feature a rather, I don't know, a really big, obvious hand puppet reaching under a tent to grab some rifles, which I did love that sequence. I don't want to make fun of that sequence, but this Yeti hand coming under the tent was a little fun. It was a fun little treat, foreshadowing. It's like, oh, there it is. There's this big paw. This massive paw.
That's a really fun scene. And then like the appearance at the end of the film, we'll probably talk a little bit more later, but maybe it goes in the campy category. Maybe it goes in the good category. We still pretty much only see like fairly limited glimpses of the Yeti, even at the end of the film, which could be a good or a bad thing. More on that later.
So much foreshadowing.
Yeah, yep. Trying to, you know, I'm emulating Val Guest and his ability to build suspense. I'm trying to anyway.
You are in shadow right now. I can only see your eyes.
I wish that were true. Sadly, it is not true. All right, so the movie came out on August 26, 1957. Reviews were positive, but it did not do very well financially. It was mostly overshadowed by the lasting popularity of The Curse of Frankenstein, which still was Hammer's number one movie of the year. Subsequent reviews since then, over the last 70 or so years, probably still a little bit mixed. Some were negative, calling the film ponderous or unexciting, and disappointing in terms of, you know, actually seeing the Yeti creatures. Other critics, however, have lauded its eerie atmosphere and attempts at thematic depth. It's generally seen as minor Hammer horror, but is also on some lists of underrated Hammer horror films. So the critical reception kind of a little bit all over the place on this one. On that note, it's time for our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information.
In Minya's mailbox, we have a comment about Space Amoeba, the 60s Toho picture directed by Ishiro Honda, from a user called The Batra on our YouTube. So The Batra says, Space Amoeba is definitely a fun movie with nice location shooting. The actors all seem like they're having a good time and the monsters are pretty cool. Honda definitely seems to be at the top of his game with the directing. It's kind of unfortunate that the script for the movie is kind of lackluster. Space Amoeba really shows that the once marvelous Toho Fantasy Film Division had long become a factory, with Honda as its chief foreman. It will be nice seeing Kamibas show up again in Tokyo SOS and Gezora showing up in Final Wars. That's in reference to those two kaiju from Space Amoeba making some cameo appearances in these Godzilla films from the 2000s. And then The Batra concludes with, also just saw The Man Who Knew Too Much with Mr. Lorre. Really liked him. He was a very good, cunning villain. So, thank you, The Batra. I'll pass that message along to Mr. Lorre. And welcome thoughts on Space Amoeba 2 from 1970.
I love that comment, and I love Space Amoeba. That's a really fun movie. I have more of a love-hate relationship with Peter Lorre, as you know, Vincent. It's a rocky relationship.
Oh, I'm not even going to touch. I'm not even going to go there, man. He's right. In Borneo. He's doing his thing. Working remote.
Working remote? Okay.
We're all over the globe. Steffi's in Greece. Peter's in Southeast Asia. You'll be in Canada soon.
Truly cosmopolitan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Peter in Southeast Asia, is there anything in the Poverty Row picture show this week?
Yes, Peter Lorre will be talking about a 1945 B-movie horror film called Fog Island, starring George Zucco and also Lionel Atwill, very well-beloved actors of horror films from the 30s and 40s. So I have yet to see this movie, but I am looking forward to catching it.
Awesome. Can't wait to hear what Peter has to say about it. I hope he's doing okay.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood. Yes, where the stars were dimmer, the red carpets dripped with blood. Together, you and I will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances, but with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. This is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. I am your host, Peter Lorre. You may know me from such razzle-dazzle pictures as Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, and The Muscle Beach Party, which is where I am headed after regaling you with my review of 1945's Fog Island. Yes, the film was produced by PRC, and it tells the mad, murderous tale of a recently released convict who was framed for the murder of his wife. Now he invites his double-crossing associates over to his foggy island home for a night of, well, murder. And unlike many Poverty Row pictures of late, the film actually stars, well, some stars. Behold, Lionel Atwill and George Zucco. Now, Atwill, for his part, had long been a mainstay of the Hollywood horror elite. He had appeared in several classics up until this point, such as Mystery of the Wax Museum, Dr. X, and as the wooden-armed police inspector in Universal Son of Frankenstein. Yes, that's right. The very inspector parodied by Mel Brooks in Young Frankenstein. Can you tell this might be a favorite film of mine? Anyways, by 1945, Atwill, alas, his star had long waned following scandal and the waning popularity of fright films. Nevertheless, he is a welcomed illumination in the murky fog of this island. Now joining him in this misty mansion of death is George Zucco. Listeners, I have mentioned this man many a time on the Poverty Row Picture Show, but I have not given him his just desserts. Along with a multitude of B-movie horrors, Zucco's best-known credits are in the Universal Mommy Pictures of the 1940s. Then, in about minute 8 of Fog Island, yes, he actually picks his nose. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is the mark of a true screen presence. Directing these monkeys at this circus is the journeyman director, Terry O'Morse. Yes, perhaps that name rings the dinosaur dinner bell, because it was Morse who directed the Americanization of Gojira. His film, of course, is known as Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and it was released in 1956, a smash of titanic proportions. Now, say what you will about the slicing and dicing of Ishiro Honda's 54 classic, but the Hollywood version propelled the famous kaiju into American pop culture. So, Mr. Terry O'Morse, we salute you. Now, Fog Island is no Godzilla. It is slowly paced, and it creaks with melodramatic intrigue. However, there is a climactic mass drowning in a basement torture chamber that would make the Phantom of the Opera proud. Ha! Now, on that note, yes, I do have a Muscle Beach party to get to with Lenore. Listeners, we'll catch you next time for, hey, what a quinky dink, The Phantom Speaks. Oh, yes, Lenore, how do you like this little one piece of mine that I am wearing? Oh, yes, well, I like the stripes and the little stars that you embroidered on the...
From the beginning of his time on Earth, man has always been fascinated by monsters, real or imagined. One enduring modern legend tells of creatures similar to man, walking upright, covered with hair, beast-like in character. Many believe they are real and exist today in the remote corners of the world where they have been driven by encroaching civilization. They were first known as the Abominable Snowmen. Lost civilizations, extraterrestrials, myths and monsters, missing persons, magic and witchcraft, unexplained phenomena. In Search of Cameras are traveling the world, seeking out these great mysteries. This program was the result of the work of scientists, researchers, and a group of highly skilled technicians.
Once a normal, voluptuously beautiful woman, she drove into a nightmare of horror and saw descending from the sky a titanic monster whose fearsome touch became a frightful curse.
You think I'm drunk, don't you? All of you! I'm not drunk! I'm not! You've got to believe me!
Please.
It was right in the middle of the highway, 30 feet tall!
Once she's in the booby hatch, throw the key away. That'll put you in the driver's seat. You'd make a wild driver, Harry. With 50 million bucks.
What she saw was beyond belief until others, too, faced its hideous, uncontrollable menace. Attack of the 50-foot woman, incredibly huge, with incredible desires for love and vengeance.
All right, back to the Abominable Snowman. Lost my train of thought there for a second. I would say the movie has a little bit more thematic depth than I expected it to have, which is obviously a good thing.
I mean, this movie has a lot on its mind. I jotted down some notes around the pursuit of knowledge and science versus superstition. The Tibetans here, they practice this kind of mysticism. The Lama, what do they talk about? It's not telepathy, but it's the ability to connect or see things or people many miles away through your mind's eye. I forget the term for that, but that's touched on. And you have the scientists, the British scientists, in this great British tradition of we're here for science and pish posh on your local superstitions. So I saw that dynamic really at play in this movie.
Totally agree. Yeah. I think, you know, some of the characters, especially Tom Friend, seem very callous and rude and condescending towards the Tibetan characters. And for a while I was like, is this also how the movie feels? Or are we supposed to, like, is this a critical portrayal? You know, that's a, kind of a fine line sometimes. But I think it is. I think we're meant to think that these British and American characters are not treating the Tibetans very well. I think it is critically portrayed, and I think part of it is exactly what you were talking about, Vincent. Like, the characters who live there in Tibet, like, have a more intimate connection with the natural world around them. Whereas, you know, I mean, even Peter Cushing's character, who's, like, relatively benevolent and, like, wants to respect the people there, it's still, he wants to get something out of it. He wants to get, like, scientific knowledge. There's even dialogue with the Lama at the monastery about that a little bit. So, you know, like, the outsiders definitely have a different relationship with this world than the Tibetans do, which is not surprising. So I think, like, some of the maybe questionable, like, things that the characters say in this movie seems to me, like, intentionally critical of, like, these attitudes that they bring in, you know?
And it comes full circle at the end when Peter Cushing comes face to face with the Yeti, and it's almost like he comes face to face with, like, these greater forces of nature that his quote unquote sensible scientific mind can't comprehend. And the last shot you see of him is in the mountains, just looking wild and kind of mad, like he's gone out of his mind, confronting these, like I said, these forces of nature that are beyond comprehension, beyond scientific rationale. So it does come full circle.
Yeah, and I love so much that then he wants to join in the secret and the mysticism. And, like, that for me is, like, that crowning moment of the film of, like, oh, that's, like, it's just so great to believe in something. And then it's even greater to believe that other people now are protecting that secret, you know, and that there are whole worlds where people, which is very Indiana Jones 3, I guess, are, like, trying to keep it, like, under wraps. But, yeah, I just, like, that's so, you know, we're, like, with Kong, it was about, like, going and great catching the great beast and bringing him to New York City and all of that stuff, where Peter Cushing's character, like, really then finally coming to understand of, like, some things, like, in this beautiful world should just be left untouched and some mysteries should just, you know, keep there. And I think that's, yeah, a nice part of the film.
I agree. I don't want to get too off on this soapbox, but I think in our 21st century, I think I'm speaking for myself, but I think I get overwhelmed so much by, like, we got to know everything, and science has touched every facets of our lives for good. Like, I'm not knocking science, but it's just who I am. I like to keep things a mystery sometimes, just for, you know, I think life is a little more interesting when you can't look up the answer on your phone. And I'm like, maybe we could just talk about it. And then if we don't come to an answer, that's okay.
It's, you know, kind of like the left brain versus right brain thing. And I think probably all three of us are more on the left brain side, like preferring that sense of like artistic expression and like mystery and just kind of like, maybe there aren't answers to some things. And then the right brain people, we need them too. We need engineers. We need scientists, obviously. But I like the left brain people. I feel like this is my community, you know?
Right brain people have just stopped listening to the show now.
Yeah.
Please come back. We need you. We love you.
Screw you, scientists. That's basically what I'm trying to say. Just kidding, of course.
You know, like, I guess I heard the debate, if it is, can it be counted as a classic monster movie? And I'd be curious to hear your guys' thoughts on that, too. You know, in a lot of ways, actually, the setup, the first attack, the first sighting, which comes at 50 minutes into the film, would say it's a classic monster movie, like, format. Yeah, and, like, this idea of the telepathy and really playing with the characters' minds and this whole thing about, you know, are they going crazy? Is there anything actually happening to them? I think that's super interesting. If you remember, there was the Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns and Homer are caught in the cabin and on a snowy hill, and they also start kind of losing their minds. And so I guess there's something to that.
Yeah.
Here, you know, where you're not, like, quite sure. I think that, yeah, again, it just adds, I think, to the very coolness of this monster. And, you know, why are we not buying abominable snowman figures? You know, I have so many monster figures, but I have never seen an option to buy one of that. And why is that? Why is this film also considered to be like a lower hammer film, you know, in all of it? And yeah, just interesting. So Fred Johnson, who is the face of the Yeti, he actually is in the Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. He's in the, like, one of the beginning scenes as a juggler. Okay, so he's not like a well known like guy, but he's like, oh, well, he's kind of like a monster movie guy. Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, what do you guys think? Like, why isn't this kind of noted historically as like a monster that we still like talk about? You know, it's you guys hadn't seen you guys have seen almost every movie ever done, and you hadn't seen it, right?
I wasn't even aware of it. I can offer some thoughts based on that, based on my freshness to the film. And this will get into my kind of personal review a little bit, so I won't repeat myself later, but I feel like the movie, I feel like the approach to the movie is, as critics have noted, very ponderous. And I think that is the primary intention of this script, is to ponder, to think the what ifs, to have these debates and these arguments around science and superstition and our place in the world and the role of exploration. I think that is also maybe too much of the focus. I found the movie to be too slow of a burn. Like, I kept expecting it to get to some action, and I don't need action. Like, this movie could have worked for me just as it was. But I think if you're going to lean so heavy into philosophizing, then you need to temper it with a little bit more overt thrills. And we get that in some points, but not enough for me in the beginning to really hold my attention.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. I think, yeah, it's hard to like find that perfect balance between like suggesting the presence of something paranormal or supernatural or whatever, but also focusing on the human characters and some of the ideas, like pushing them forward. And to me, like, this movie doesn't totally find that balance. Like, I think earlier on, there should be more suggestions of something is wrong. There's something out there in the wilderness, you know? So yeah, I would agree with everything that Vincent said. But it is interesting, like, why has the Abominable Snowman not really become, like, a prominent monster, like, figure in our, like, cultural imagination to the same extent that, like, Dracula or Frankenstein or the Mummy has? And I guess I don't know the answer to that. Maybe simply because, like, in cinematic history, there haven't been a lot of great, like, representations of it, you know? Or even in, like, literary history, as far as I know. So, yeah, like, I think this is, in a way, a classic monster movie in the sense of, like, it hits all the beats, even, like, the very common theme of, like, man is the true monster. You know, this movie, it certainly has that as well. But is it a classic in terms of, like a personal favorite or even, like, beloved by general fans? Probably not, unfortunately, but that's, you know, some people love it. And that's the beauty of subjective opinion, obviously, which we'll get into in just a second here.
And I will add then, Matt, what you brought up. Like, you're comparing it to Dracula and Frankenstein on all these. In this movie, The Abominable Snowman, I'm just talking about, like, visually, the monster design and the fact that we only see the monster right at the last, you know, 5 minutes of the movie. Steffi, why don't you have a figure of this monster? Because we don't really see it. So, like,
right?
Can you put that on a poster? Can you put that on merchandise? It doesn't. The way it is created isn't, I don't think, lends itself easily to that aspect of monster movie fandom. But it's an interesting looking monster. I would have liked to have seen more of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe a small part of it, too, is that, like, the point of the movie, for the most part, thematically, is that, like, the Yetis are gentle and wise and, like, you know, good. They're like, not evil at all. And I feel like the fascination with monsters is that it allows people to, like, get in touch with their dark side a little bit and the violence and the evil of humanity, like, that other sort of dark side of human nature or whatever, you know? So for a monster, that's really not that at all. Like, it's just a good, like, thing, you know? Maybe there's not really a lot of, like, fascination with that, you know?
Yet. Maybe now we'll turn a new page.
And, yeah, exactly.
Everyone will check it out. And yeah. Originally, too, it's not, because I was also thinking, oh, maybe it's because it's a Western, like, idea of a monster, right? In the Himalayas, this, like, foreign world. But actually, the Sherpas originally were the ones to claim that this monster existed. So it was the Tibetan people itself. It's a local lore that did get exported to the outside world. So I find that interesting. It is like a local tale. I found some interesting names that they used to refer to it in Tibetan. They would, which they silly, would translate to the filthy snowman. So people would say, like, oh, don't go over there. The filthy snowman's going to get you. And there was one more. Oh, yeah, the stinky bear. Not sure why, where that someone smelt it, but yeah, it's an interesting. And there's a great documentary narrated by Leonard Nimoy on YouTube about the quest for the Abominable Snowman.
Nice.
Which is just sort of the historical searching for it. So yeah, if you're interested in that backstory, check that out. It's pretty good.
Is that called In Search Of?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I have two source books that I was pulling information from, and I have other cryptozoology books on my shelf.
That's so great.
Yeah, that was a thing I was really into when I was a kid.
Yeah, that you'll have to send that to me. I'd love to read it and just know about, like, I didn't know about the Mothman. I was reading about it today, too. I was like, oh, there's so many cool untapped monsters here. We got whole franchises to build.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's start making those instead of Dracula for the 500th time, you know?
Honestly, like, on film, I don't think the Yeti has a rich or extensive pedigree. So This is the only one I know of. And
I did want to mention real quick, the only other Abominable Snowman I can think of in movies is in Monsters, Inc., a movie that I really love. And the Yeti there is also really kind and generous and fun to be around. So maybe that's a running theme. But
welcome to the Himalayas.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Love that movie. Which we should talk about sometime.
We should.
But yeah, back to the Abominable Snowman. Starting with the good category, obviously we've talked about a lot of good stuff.
This, I think Forrest Tucker's death at the end, where the camera sort of gives him this space, and slowly as he's lurching to his final moments of life, and he's looking up and realizing this is it, out of all my stupid life, this is now over. I think that's kind of a nice moment that he played really well. I think he's a good actor, and I thought that, you know, he could have done or like something like that, but he just looks death in the face.
Yeah.
You know, as he accepts it, as he was, you know, he caused it himself, basically. So yeah, that's a highlight for. And then Peter Cushing's, like, I don't know, makeup, where he kind of looks like Jack Nicholson at the end of The Shining when he's frozen. I don't know what they did to him, but I just feel like they look really similar in that scene. I don't know if Kubrick took that, or that's just like default frozen. I'm frozen in snow makeup, but I thought that looked pretty cool.
I made the same connection. That's great. Vincent, what's in your good category?
Yes to Forrest Tucker's death. I think he reacts the way realistically you would, just kind of frozen with fear and just like, okay. But that shot, the way his face is framed looking up, is then mirrored in Peter Cushing when he's looking up at the Yeti. It's like the same blocking and the same framing. And I caught that mirroring effect. There's a shot of Forrest Tucker's buddy who he has a heart attack and he dies. And he's like a really gung-ho hunter, trapper. But there's a brief shot of his dead body and his face is frozen in this petrified scream. And the way he's shadowed, that was a very gripping shot. Yeah, I think there are some individual shots in this film that are really effective. The Yeti's arm, like they shoot at the monster and the creature just leaves this dismembered arm on the snow. That was a very effective prop, very unsettling. The score, I want to shout out. I really thought achieved a level of eeriness and atmosphere. Yeah, I think all the technical components of this movie are spot on.
Agreed. Yeah, I think in the good category, I would say the visual style for sure. I like how there are a lot of longer takes and like the camera sort of, there are a lot of tracking shots, but they don't really like call attention to themselves. It's like a conversation will go on for a while and the camera will start with a certain composition and then like readjust to like, you know, change the frame and bring in more characters and change, like take a different view of the setting and all that. So I love that visual style. And I think Guest and Arthur Grant, I think is the cinematographer, do a really good job with that. And I do appreciate that the movie does have ideas on its mind. You know, it's not just a monster movie. I mean, we love monster movies, of course, but it's like, you know, it's a familiar theme, like the monstrosity of man and like these different cultural divides. Like, it's not especially groundbreaking, but I am pleased that the movie is trying to like discuss those things and set up those contrasts.
Yeah.
But moving on to the bad category, Vincent, maybe we'll turn to you first and we'll kind of go in the opposite order so we can end with Steffi in this case.
Okay. Okay. I'll try to keep it brief. Three main points. I'm looking at these critiques from a structural standpoint, and knowing that this is based off of a play, a stage play, some of these critiques make more sense. Maybe it works best on stage, doesn't translate to film as well as much. So I would have liked to have seen more. I would have liked to have established the threat of nature and the elements earlier in the film. They do a little foreshadowing, for example, of the avalanche. But I'm like, what if they had a red shirt in their party who dies in that moment? Easy way to establish some stakes. Like, oh, you really can get killed in this world. Okay, then moving on to number two. I think the subplot with Helen Rollison, Dr. Rollison's wife, and Foxy. I like that there's a subplot. However, I don't feel like the subplot really added anything to the forward momentum of the movie. Every time we cut to Mrs. Rollison, it was, is my husband okay? Is my husband okay? And like we alluded to earlier, I think, what if there was like a little romantic intrigue? What if she was in danger from the Sherpas, which would have been problematic, but it would have added something, some peril, some sense of danger to her story that I think the movie could have used. Oh, I think the movie could have used some comedic relief. This is a very serious movie, which I don't mind, but maybe a comic relief character in some small way could have added a little bit. And then finally, I'll say, the madness. So I keep going, like, they use, by the end, our characters are hearing voices in their minds, which is such a great conceit, especially on stage and in the movies. And yet I've seen the conceit of madness on film, like maybe The Shining, for example, used to greater effect. I think the direction could have been bolder. The editing could have been bolder to really drive home the insanity. As it stands, I'm like, I see what you're doing, but I'm a little underwhelmed by the insanity of these characters.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. I'll just add like one thing real quick and then we'll turn to you, Steffi. But I would agree with that, Vincent. I think ultimately it is sort of unexciting. I would just use the word boring for like, you know, probably the first 45 minutes or so. I think like a lot of that is due to a sense of repetition, you know, like Vincent, you talked about the scenes cutting back to Helen and Foxy and how they don't really add anything, but also several of the conversations between Dr. Rollison and Friend and Ed are kind of the same thing over and over again, like establishing their kind of different motivations for finding the Yeti. And, you know, it's like Ed's kind of like gung-ho nature. You said that before, Vincent. And Tom Friend is kind of like self-serving interest. And then Peter Cushing is in it for the sake of science. Like those conversations are kind of had over and over again in the movie. And it's like, it's already relatively short at 90 minutes, but like you could have cut out some of those scenes and made it like 75 minutes and it would have been a little tighter, you know? So unfortunately, just a little unexciting for me for most of its running time. I also feel like I'm kind of okay with a slow burn, but I could have used more in this case. So we're being a little hard on it, but Steffi, is there any other bad stuff that you saw?
Well, they're really good points for sure. And yeah, I think the only other thing that they could have explored is maybe something with the llama. So like the llama, like he's like, no, there's nothing up there. Then they're like, okay, we're going to go then. And he's like, okay. And I don't know, they maybe could have develop something like more interesting, because then also too, when Helen's like went to go find the llama, suddenly she's sort of like tackled and like, you know, so there, like the llama could have had some kind of interesting play in it, but you know, underdeveloped of course, but
yeah,
I think like your points are really fair about the film. And yeah, I think, but just to end on a positive note, like looking at what they did and seeing, you don't see many films like that of that era, you know, like that it's a visually striking enough film that you really are like kind of swept away. And I really have to like praise that. And to imagine, never climbed a mountain in my life, but maybe, you know, if you are climbing a snowy mountain, it's slow and, you know, a cold burn.
Yeah.
Like yeah. That. Maybe that's what they were trying to go for too. True. Is yeah, to mirror that atmosphere and then to kind of slowly get claustrophobic in that space.
Yeah.
Just an idea, but.
And I agree. I think it is a choice. So, I mean, Val Guest is a talented director. I mean, everyone involved are making their choices. So whether or not it's your cup of tea, that's one thing, but I do respect the choices. Like you said, this commitment to the environment. So maybe we're really in that realism. I do want to watch this again. I will say, like, it's not the first movie from this era where I was a little underwhelmed, but upon further watches, I really start to see it on different levels. And it's like, yeah, you know what? Everything's happening between the lines. Like, we don't need a thrilling set piece because, again, everything is happening a little more on a subtle level.
And I think you have a really good point, Steffi, that like you really do feel the endless climb up the mountain, like all these shots of them just like trudging through the snow. You know, maybe a couple times I was like, all right, we get it already. But at the same time, it's like you feel how difficult that would be, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a good point. We do always try to shout out like one or two of our favorite campy moments in the film as well. Very briefly, I'll say that I always love especially in old, well, not just in older movies, but like whenever somebody falls off a cliff and then there's a cut to something else and it's very obviously a dummy. This movie has a really good example of that with one character who falls off a cliff. And then there's a cut that made me laugh out loud.
Because we mentioned the hand.
Yeah, the hand, which was like comically large, right? I wasn't just seeing that. Like it was bigger than the rifles. Like they were little rifles used to convey the giantness of the hand. But yeah. No, also we've talked about how long it takes to climb up this mountain in reverse, how quickly it takes to descend the mountain. Because there's that knight, which is a great set piece. Like I don't want listeners to think that there's no action in this movie, because when there is action, it's really good. So there's this knight attack on the tent and everyone's running around in chaos, firing their guns. And the Sherpa, he sees the hand and he loses it. He hightails it down the mountain so fast. And then I thought he was dead. Like I thought he was going to be lost to the wilderness. But then he shows up in camp again in the village. And they're like, yeah, he got down here in like 3 hours. Wow.
He do a shortcut.
Yeah.
Just rolling down the mountain. I love that.
Yeah.
Steffi, we have a pretty broad definition of camp on this show, but was there anything that stuck out to you, like silly or campy in that category?
I mean, the choice that Forrest Tucker's character, whatever like scandal he was involved in before, he decides to rename himself Friend. And so like having Peter Cushing call Friend, and then it's like the Friend explores on like all of his stuff. I just thought that was kind of an odd, distracting choice.
I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
Friend!
Tom Good Guy.
Yeah.
For a character who's not especially likable, you know? So
right.
a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we have arrived at the end of our episode. This is the point of every episode where we give the film a rating. As always, we have 4 ratings on Camp Kaiju. Our highest rating, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number 2, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number 3, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it's not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time. For me, I'm going to go just like slightly on the negative side. I do think this movie, not especially fun, although it has its interesting moments and like it does have an eerie atmosphere at times. I admire some of the things it's trying to do, but for me, it probably does not stand the test of time. I think there are probably other Hammer horror movies, even other underrated ones, especially those that I'll, you know, maybe prefer over time. And perhaps I'll watch this again and have a better opinion the next time around. But for me, on this first rewatch, I was a little bit disappointed and felt that it did move a little too slow for its own good. Vincent, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Matt, and well said. Yeah, my first inclination was towards that rating as well. However, in the midst of our conversation, I think I'm going to stay on the slightly positive side, and I'm going to say that there are some dated elements in character. Maybe it is a little too slow moving for its own good, but I think the visual style stands the test of time. I think those set pieces, while few and far between, while they're saved like for the end, like the last 20 minutes is all action, that action is done compellingly enough for me to want to go back and watch this movie. So I think it does stand the test of time in a lot of ways, not so much in some ways, but stands the test of time.
Nice.
So I don't know if this classifies as stand the test of time, because historically it is exactly like a perfect movie. Like, so if you watch it as a 1957 like reflection on society and what was happening at the time and, you know, all the things in the world, that to me is a perfect capsule, actually. And even the slowness of it, actually, to me. So for me, I feel like it does stand the test of time because it's such a special reflection of knowing that there was explorers going up the mountains at those times, you know, looking for it. There was this thing with the Americans and the Brits, you know, kind of, I guess we're allies after all that stuff. You know, there's that kind of tension and that sort of mysticism that was starting to kind of be removed, I think, as science started to evolve more in the 60s and we were, you know, the moon landing and all this stuff that came after it. I think that there's something really beautiful in kind of capturing the way that the times were. So I would say I'm the highest. I still really love this movie. Yeah, I think it's just totally special, totally different. I know the slow burn with all of us, like, drives us crazy the way we're all wired now. But, and yeah, I guess critics at the time, too, were also saying it was slow. So think about it. It was even slow for them in the 50s. It's crazy. But, yeah, that there's a charm to it.
Yeah.
So I'm all for the best rating for this one.
Right on. That's great.
Yeah, I love that. And that, like, the historical context is very important, and that's a good point. So thank you for bringing that up. But I love the array of reactions we had to it, you know? Anybody out there that's seen The Abominable Snowman, let us know what you think, or other Hammer horror movies for that matter. Steffi, thank you again for joining us today. It was so wonderful to meet you and talk with you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
absolutely. We will, like, put your handle, your Instagram handle, in the show notes, and hopefully we'll have you on the show again at some point in the future. But thank you again.
I would love that. Thanks. A total pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, the honor was ours. If you want to say any last words about what you got going on, if there's anything you want people to follow or check out with your professional work, you can have the floor for a minute if you want.
Oh, sure. Yeah, if you're into, like, monster history in very small doses, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. It's at Steffi Theodora, and that's also on Instagram. I post a new monster movie minute every Monday. And, yeah, that's... So, spoiler alert, I do show kind of my favorite parts of the movie to show you that you need to see the movie. But then I also go into a lot of history and stuff like that. So, if that's up your alley, follow me on Instagram. Yeah, or on YouTube.
Amazing. Again, such a pleasure. We'll let you get out of here, but we hope to have you back.
Thanks for hanging out with us, friends. Please rate and review the show and follow us on patreon.com/campkaiju for additional videos, reviews, merchandise, and more. Other ways to get in touch: campkaiju@gmail.com, campkaijupodcast.com, Instagram, and our voicemail number at 612-470-2612. Camp Kaiju was recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Mina's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information.
Thanks, and catch us next time for Blackula.
Yeah, can't wait. That's going to be a fun episode.
We have great stores of all these herbs.
You can really spare them.
Take what you wish now, then you will have every species.
Species?
Species. It's a long time since I have studied your language.
The Research Foundation will be greatly in your debt, sir.
Mr. Fox, you do not drink your tea?
Oh, I do. Well, I mean, I will. Actually, I think I'll go and collect some jars to put these in.
It will be cold.
Well, really, I quite like it cold.
One more thing, dear campers, in this world of uncertainty, I just want to acknowledge the death of Alex Preddy at the hands of ICE agents. That has happened in the time from recording to release. So, Minneapolis, again, we're with you. Whole world, think of Minneapolis and may you always stand for what is right. So, Alex Preddy, Renee Good, rest in power. Everyone out there, stay campy and stay strong. And if you ever wonder what the word mensch means, well, maybe my favorite non-monster movie, Billy Wilder's The Apartment, may shed some light on that beautiful word that we all ought to think about more and more every day. So I'll leave you with that. Be a mensch.
Why don't you grow up, Baxter? Be a mensch. You know what that means?
I'm not sure.
A mensch, a human being.